across Europe. We're going to come back, and Jim's going to tell some American anecdotes with some very interesting concept about anxiety. We're going to look at folk tales and the role of ballads in Ireland. And Norman Kennedy has a great wealth of stories that he himself has collected in Scotland. So that's where we're going. When we finish the presentations, which will all be about 10 minutes in length, then we're going to introduce one special guest who's going to tell a tall tale and a very short family anecdote or family story, which is something that I have a particular interest in. Then we're going to have a discussion amongst the panel about the role of folk tales outside of the context of our particular interest, in just in general terms. And then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. And we'll just see what happens from there. Okay. The presentation that I would like to make, I'd like to kind of draw a picture of the people that came over here to America. Often, they were not able to bring their grandfather's bedstead with them, or the old clock. None of them brought a bagpipe, especially to West Virginia. Frank George says he never saw a bagpipe in the traditional, you know, stories and things about people that played music here. So a lot of times all they could bring was pretty much the clothes on their back. And they brought their stories. That was their wealth. That's what they brought here into the mountains. When they got here in the mountains, also they began to develop their own folklore. And folk stories, I think, take a great amount of time to evolve and develop. And the American anecdote, or the tall tale, although it's found in Europe, has really kind of found its real home, especially the tall tale here in America. And it very much was part and parcel of the new frontier and the exaggerated, preposterous tale built up with a great deal of believable evidence and particulars. Okay. Well, one of the tales that is very popular amongst American tellers is the Jack tale, you know, stories about Jack. But before I tell this Jack tale, I'd like to show how the Jack tale really changed coming over from England. And unfortunately, what's happening now is, and I'm in the schools a lot, and I say, what's the Jack tale you all know? Everybody says, Jack and the Beanstalk. And I'll say, well, that's just because someone published a tale. See, tales change, stories change. But somebody published that Jack and the Beanstalk story, and now it's available in books. And so we have our kids reading this story, which is very much an English story, an Anglo, you know, story. And it talks about Jack. And Jack, in the English Jack tales, is a kind of a dashing hero figure, kind of cocksure. And well, in America, Jack's a kind of different character. He's a little bit more of the trickster type. He's a little more laid back. He sometimes runs a little afoul of the law, as we perceive law. He's clever. He's very unassuming. Well, I might. Maybe. That kind of stuff. And then we got to talking a little bit with Frank Hart, and he said in Ireland, Jack, again, is a whole different character, which maybe Frank would bring up later. So I'd like to take this story, and this story was collected by Vance Randolph, a great collector, besides his very well-known classic, Pissing in the Snow, which everyone seems to know that one. He also wrote some other ones called The Day They Blew Up the Church House, We Always Lie to Strangers. And this one is called Jack and the Cornstalk. And it was collected, and it's the real item, and it was shown how that story and Jack evolved when it got into the mountains of the Ozarks, which I feel are a very close cousin to our own mountains here. And the mountain culture, I don't really see West Virginia and Pennsylvania and North Carolina really being separate areas. It's more mountain people and flatlanders and ridge runners, as we'll find out later. Well, Jack, he was going to see his friends. He'd traveled through the woods across the mountain to get over to his friend's house. When he got up on the ridge, he came through a little patch of a clearing. The grass was pretty high through there, and as he walked through, he looked down on the ground. He saw this old dead black crow laying there, had its wings stretched out. Jack looked and saw it had something unusual in its beak. Kind of took his attention. So he reached down, and he fished it out and held it up, and it was a kernel of corn. But it wasn't like any kernel of corn he'd ever seen. See, it wasn't yellow and small. Instead, it was blue as the sky and as big as a black walnut. And he couldn't figure where a crow could get hold of a kernel of corn that looked like that. But he was a curious lad, so he went and found a little stick, and he punched a hole there in that clearing in the ground, pushed that kernel down in there, you know, and covered it up and patted the earth real good. And then he got his big hat and went down to the stream, filled it up with creek water, and came back and poured it on that kernel of corn. And he stood back and waited for it to grow. It was pretty hot and kind of buggy, and after a while he got tired of that because nothing ever happened. So he went home. Well, I guess he went to his friends and then he went home. It was about a month before he went back up through that place again to go to see his friend. And when he came into that clearing, don't you know, that corn had grown up into a corn stalk that just was so tall it disappeared up into the clouds. It just towered above him. Why, it had regular tree bark around it. Blade fodder hanging down off that thing 40 feet long. Jack looked at it and couldn't hardly believe his eyes. Now that was a corn stalk. Well, he got excited like Jack does on occasion, and he just ran back home and bust in the door, and he said, "Mama," he said, "Daddy, come here." He said, "Oh, we got to go up the mountain." He said, "You just won't believe it." He said, "There's a corn stalk up there. Beats all corn stalks I ever saw." And he got to tell them all about it. And they just listened, you know. And after he finished going on about it, they kind of started this kind of smirky grin and said, "Jack, that's one of your tales. I ain't going up on the mountain. Have you go, hey, no corn stalk after all." Go to laughing at your mom and papa. They said they weren't going. Well, Jack got mad. You know how young'un will do. Got real mad. He said, "I'll show you." Didn't know what else to say, so he repeated it. He said, "I'll show you." And he went out and slammed the door, and he brooded all the way back up to that corn stalk. And when he got to looking at it, he said, "I'll climb this corn stalk if I don't see the back of my neck." And he reached up onto that big old tree bark, and he started climbing up, you know. And he climbed up, and he'd take his leg and put it up over one piece of blade fodder and another, and he kept climbing up there and climbing, got higher and higher, you know. Now, that corn stalk looked like a great big tree, like used to grow in this country, but it was hollow, just corn stalk, see. And after he got up there a piece, it started doing this. And he looked down, everything gotten real small, and he could see clean over the top of the woods all the way down to his farm where his parents were. But he didn't stop, he kept climbing. Pretty soon it got real foggy like, and he couldn't see anything. And then he came through the fog, and you know what he saw was the biggest field he'd ever laid eyes on. Oh, it just stretched out, seemed like forever in every direction. And the grass in that field was over 10 feet tall. Why, the ironweed in that field was as big as apple trees down here. Old Jack thought he'd have a look around and stretch his legs. So he got off that corn stalk and started looking, you know. And way down towards one end of the field, he seen these great big monstrous sheep. Lord, biggest thing he'd ever seen. Probably bigger than elephants. He'd never seen an elephant. He'd read about them. Bigger than anything he'd ever seen, black bears or, you know, prize bulls or anything. These sheep were down there eating that 10-foot grass. So he went down there and got to looking at them, and the big daddy sheep, don't you know, had one of them big bells hanging around his neck, like they put on the sheep tail where they've got to. Oh, it was a monstrous big bell, and Jack got to thinking, if he went back down that corn stalk and told his parents about these great big monstrous sheep and that big old ironweed and stuff, they'd just say, "Some more of your tales, Jack, huh?" So he knew he'd have to take something back to show them it was the truth. He got to eyeing that bell, and his hand slipped in his pocket, and he got that old Barlow knife out and opened her up, and he started sawing on that leather strap. It was over a foot thick now. Took a long time with that sharp knife, but he sawed through it, and when he did, that bell fell, pa-blang, on the ground. It was way too big to carry, so Jack, all he could do was just start pushing it or kind of flipping it over. And every time he'd roll it over, that clapper'd come down, bong, and his ears start ringing. You know, but Jack was determined when he got his mind set on something, that's the way it was going to be. So he kept pushing that bell over towards, you know, where the corn stalk came up through the field. And every time he did, that clapper would come down. Boom! Jack's getting a headache and he's pushing that big old bell. And sure enough, just as he got to the corn stalk, he heard a terrible roar, sound like all the thunder in the world. And he turned around and here comes old Giant. John heard that bell, you know, and figured out what Jack was doing, stealing it. Oh, he was mad. He was swinging a big club up over his head as he come a running, as big as a saw log, I'm telling you. Well, Jack was right there at the cornstalk, so he just pushed that bell that last time, and it went down through the hole there in the meadow. Whew, disappeared in the clouds. And Jack, he jumped up onto the cornstalk, took one more look at that giant. He was just a running down the field towards, and Jack started down. Well, giant saw he wasn't going to quite catch him, so he threw that club, and that club came just a sailing and raised the hair on his head as it just missed him, you know. And Jack had gotten away. Well, he just skimmied down that thing as fast as he could. When he got to the ground, his heart a pounding, he looked up, and he saw the giant was so mad. And he wanted that bell, and he wanted to get hold of Jack. He jumped on that corn stalk himself and started, you know, coming down it. It just, like I told you, it wasn't really a tree. It looked like one. It's just a corn stalk, hollow inside. And, you know, that old giant was way too heavy. And next thing you know, that thing starts going like this. And next thing you know, there's a cracking sound, and it came off at the ground. Old giant came roaring down that mountain, and when he hit, he broke open like an old rotten apple. And that was the end of him. Well, Jack, now that'd been an adventure, so he ran back home, and he was just all sweated up, and he was just so sincere that finally his parents thought something was up. And so they went to see what he was talking about, and they got up there and found that old giant laying there. Well, they went and told all the people around there in the settlement. They all came out that night. There was a full moon, and they buried the old giant at nighttime. Dug a big pit, maybe 20, 30 men all digging, see? Got the giant buried. They didn't want to do it in the day in case, you know, New York Times or CBS News get hold of it. And they come down, stir up a bunch of trouble, and get everybody talking about everybody else. And they just thought it was best to keep it secret. Well, you know the funniest thing after that, for about 2 years, well, everywhere you went in that settlement, people kept showing off these real pretty woolen saddle blankets and lap robes and stuff like that, you know. And don't you know, it was all made from the wool on that one pair of pants they got off the old giant before they buried him. And it was about, I think, about a year later, maybe, these two boys were blackberry picking. And they're in the briars, and all of a sudden they came across this big, enormous bell laying there in the briars. Oh, it was a monstrous big thing. And then they remembered Jack's story. And they went and told Jack and Jack's dad, and they came up and looked at it, went down to talk to the Methodist minister. See, they'd built him a new church house there, had a steeple and all, but they never could afford a good bell for it. So they said, Jack said, well, I'll get the team and we'll scoot that thing out of the briars and we'll go put it up in the bell tower for you if you want. Oh no, that Methodist minister wouldn't have a thing to do with it. He said, no telling who made that bell, could have been the devil. He said, and beside, you can't never tell what might come running when you go to ringing it on Sunday morning. And that's the story of Jack. I would like now to introduce Mick Maloney, who's going to share some different thoughts and ideas. Mick we won't go into all the academic degrees, but he's quite a folklorist, besides a tremendous performer and musician.
Mick? Well, one thing, I'm not as a storyteller. I go in for the music and the singing, really. Storytelling is an interest of mine, and folk tales in general. You know, in Ireland, it's a small country, as you know, and until recently, pretty rural, in the sense that you can only say there are maybe three towns of any size in Ireland, you know. I mean, there's Dublin, and there's Cork, and there's Belfast, and I was born near a great big city of 50,000 people. We thought it was very big. But there's never the kind of separation, apart from Dublin, I suppose, and Belfast, between the town and the country that you would find in England, for instance, where the Industrial Revolution and the whole pattern of urban settlement created a big distinction between urban and rural culture. So until very recently, Ireland was a very rural culture, and every aspect of the rural culture was sort of interrelated. So if you were interested in songs, there was always stories related to the songs, and many of the themes in the songs were also part of the folk tales in a particular locality. And there were even stories about music, the instrumental music, great body of tales of how people would learn music from the fairies, particularly pipers, who seemed to have a knack for meeting the fairies and dark nights, dark, windy nights in lonesome parts of the country, and learn tunes from them that had never been heard in that region before, and sometimes ever heard by any mortal before. In Irish life, going back many hundreds of years, the storyteller, or the Shanachie, as it's called in the Gaelic language, occupied a very prominent position, going back many hundreds of years ago to the time when, before the English had taken over control over Ireland, political and economic and social, and there was a whole Celtic order of chieftains in different parts of the country. In those times, the bard, the fila, the poet, and the storyteller occupied a very proud position, almost an aristocratic position in the society. And even after that whole order vanished under the might of English colonial power, within rural Ireland, the storyteller, the man of words, the woman of words, occupied a very prominent position in the whole culture, a very valued position, and at the top, you might say, of the hierarchy of the great artists of the people. And the Shanachie was a very distinguished figure in Gaelic-speaking Ireland up to, well, just a few short decades ago, when the old order that was in danger of disappearing for a long time finally did disappear. The old Celtic stories, the big stories, and when I say story, well, we use the word story in different ways in Ireland. There are two distinctions, I suppose. There are many different kinds, but two main distinctions between different kinds of stories. And the older people would make a distinction between Scéal and Shanachas. And Scéal was the story, was the big story, the old stories, the stories of bygone days, stories about strange events and mysterious happenings. And Shanachas was, it's very hard to translate it exactly. It's like gossip, but it's not quite gossip. It's more the everyday or the non-exceptional. And the people, the older people in older Ireland, made a very big distinction between the big stories, which had been handed down and were told by gifted people who were skilled in the verbal arts, and between Shanachas, which really was the province of the everyday person and wasn't considered of any tremendous artistic significance. And the big stories, the Scéal, well, there were many different kinds of stories, and they existed in rural Ireland for many hundreds of years in different variants. Some of them were of the old mythological, historical cycle, stories that told of the early waves of Celts. And, of course, the Irish and the Scots are both branches of the great Celtic empires that swept across Europe at various stages and found their last home on the rocky outskirts of Europe, and the highlands of Scotland, and in the rocky cliffs of the west of Ireland, and particularly in the southwest and the northwest, and along the west coast where Gaelic was spoken up to very recently, and still is in some areas called Gaeltachtaí. And the stories there were the big stories were of the early days of the Celts, stories of ancient figures, and folklore is called those stories part of the mythological cycle. The historical cycle of the early days, and much of the early history of Ireland is constructed from manuscript accounts of the early monks of those stories in somewhat chronological order. And then the next great body of tale was the Finíocht, the story of Finn MacCool and his band of warriors that roamed Ireland and protected the country against foreign marauders, and those stories also are very much part of the lore of Gaelic-speaking Scotland. And the third great cycle, the cycle of the Ulster cycle, and the Ulster cycle revolves around the tales of Cuchulainn, who was the defender of Ulster in the cattle raid of Cooley and the great battles that took place between the province of Connacht in the west and the province of Ulster in the north of Ireland. And interestingly enough, when you think of that vast body of horrific and wonderful and spellbinding tales of a fight that was fought because a king and a queen were boasting to each other over the relative prowess of their bulls. And when you see how much Irish life is embedded in the story of the land and the farming of the land and the importance of livestock on the land, it's not all that surprising that the greatest battle of all in the whole of Irish folk history should have been fought about cattle. They're the older stories, and many variants of them survive in the folklore department of University College Dublin. Ireland had a very enlightened policy in the early years of the independence of the 26 counties of collecting the old folklore of the country, and the Irish Folklore Commission was established to salvage and collect and place in archives the last remnants of the vanishing Gaelic order that had contributed so much to the artistic life of the country for so long. They weren't the only tales, lots of legends, and folklorists wonder all the time about defining legends. It's often thought that a legend is defined by a certain amount of belief in what it is that people are telling about, even though there's often a suspension of disbelief rather than belief. A lot of those stories are about the fairies, and the fairies are very mysterious people. People theorize that the fairies were the descendants of one wave of Celts who were the most magically inclined, the Tuatha De Danann, who were defeated in battle by successive waves of Celts and who went into a different dimension, perhaps even went underground, and continued to live with the modern world in a strange, mysterious way under their own rules and their own circumstances. And the fairies were, they were feared, they were loved, they were always respected in rural Ireland. And there are many different kinds of fairies. There are the trooping, marauding fairies used to come through the countryside at nighttime, creating havoc wherever they went. And the fairies that were the most feared of all were the fairies who would come and take little children, male children, and substitute changelings who would sicken and die within a short space of time. And this was due to a belief that the fairies, male fairies, were impotent, and they needed human beings to replenish their stock, as it were. And I know that that belief existed up to very recently, even in my own family. And I grew up for the first few years of my life with my grandparents in the wilds of County Kerry, and learned to my great interest from my grandmother that my uncles, along with most of the men at that time, were dressed in skirts, in girls' clothes, until they were 5 years of age, to deceive the fairies who might otherwise come and take them if they thought they were of the male sex. And I think Frank, too, would have a knowledge of that, and that belief has existed until very, very recently in certain parts of Ireland. Belief in the fairies is kind of interesting. William Butler Yeats, the great poet, was very interested in the magical world of rural Ireland, and he asked a woman once in Connemara, did she believe in the fairies? And she says, "I do not, but they're there." kind of indicates the ambiguous regard for the world of magic, the mysterious other world that Irish people always have had and can, I think, continue to have. Then there's the whole body of tales which are not necessarily about fairies, even though they're called fairy tales. They're Martian, I suppose, would be what they're called by the folklorists in general. Tales that are found all over Europe, Jack and the Beanstalk would be one category of those tales. Tales about the mysterious world of giants and goblins and various extraterrestrial beings who inhabit our time and space in strange ways. And those tales are found also in Ireland. As I said, they're called fairy tales, but they're not to be confused with tales about the fairies that we have in Ireland. You know, it's thought that, well, the stories have died out now, and that's not so at all. I go home to Ireland once every year for about a month or so, if I can, and I'm struck immediately with the fine quality of talk, is the verbal art, I suppose. And talk is very highly valued in Irish society. And you know, the pub fulfills a very central kind of role in Irish society, but even though drinking is something that we enjoy in Ireland, and the pub is more than a place to drink, it's a place where people meet and talk and reaffirm community ties. And the babble of conversation that you hear going into any large or small pub in Ireland is a testimony to the fact that the Irish love to talk, and that good talking, verbal art of one kind or another, is very, very, very highly valued. And when people talk about storytelling you know, say that it's died out, well, perhaps the big stories are gone, and perhaps the stories about the fairies and the magical world are gone, but the art of talking artistically is as much alive in Ireland as it ever was. I really firmly believe that. It's just the forms have changed. With modernization, technologies, communication, television, radio, and so on, a lot of the belief systems that informed the old tales and were at the center of the old tales have indeed disappeared. But the stories continue in a new form about life. And when somebody says somebody is great to tell a yarn, it's a way of saying they're a great storyteller. And they mightn't be telling stories about Finn McCool or Cuchulainn or any of the great ancient heroes of mythological times in Ireland, but they're talking about what's significant in their day-to-day lives. And in that sense, folk tales, as defined by the way the people create their own and shape their own artistic communication, folk tales are as alive and as widespread and as vital and as vibrant as they ever were. You could say that jokes, different kinds of jokes, are forms of tales. And you know, in Ireland we have the very same sort of I suppose stereotyping or scapegoating phenomenon is nearly every different culture. And whereas there may be Polish jokes in America, Irish jokes in England, there are Kerryman jokes in Ireland about this small little part of Ireland where the people are considered to be fair game for scapegoating, you know. We have lots of different categories of stories. The favourite categories of stories concern Irishmen and Englishmen and Scotsmen. And needless to say, the Irishman always comes out on top. The Englishman tends not to do so well. I remember one particular story I heard recently about two Irishmen and two Englishmen and two Welshmen and two Scotsmen that were shipwrecked on a far distant desert island. And they weren't discovered for about 3 months. And when they were discovered, it was found that certain cultural developments had taken place which were somewhat predictable. The two Scotsmen had built a distillery and were enjoying the fruits of their labour.
Yes.
The two Irish people were having a protracted argument and neither seemed to be winning. The two Welshmen had formed, all just with the two of them, a four-part harmony choir, and they were singing away in great style. And the two Englishmen were still waiting to be introduced.
Well, there's two things. One is an Irishman is never at peace unless he's in a good fight. And the other one I like very much has to do with what Mick said, is why the Irishman prefers drink to food. It interferes less with conversation. I'd like to introduce Frank Hart, who is a very fine ballad singer. And when we first asked him to be part of this, he scratched his head and said, "Well, you've got Mick, and he knows this and that." And he said, "I just sing the ballads." And we've been in our class looking at ballads very seriously. In fact, today we had a marvelous day. We had some people come into our class that sang some ballads that were really beautiful. And the storylines and those kind of things, I think, really helps build background for storytellers. It gives the whole context in which these beliefs and stories came out of. So I'm going to introduce Frank Hart, and he's going to, I think, talk about the particulars of a particular ballad.
But you see, I'm but a poor shadow of my eloquent friend Mick Maloney. He speaks. I need to hear. I bring him along because when I'm asked hard questions, I get Mick to answer them. And
I'm so grateful too.
I am.
So you notice where I kept them apart.
If there are any hard questions after this, please address them to Mick. He'll give you a very clear answer to them. I know nothing at all about storytelling, except I love listening to stories. And basically, the ballads to me, the first thing that attracted me about ballads is the fact that each ballad is telling a story. I've said this before, our ballads are something more than entertainment. They carry within them the expression of a people. And so much of our history has been one of oppression that so many of our ballads deal with this oppression. And they carry within them the hopes of a nation or the disappointments, the tragedies or the defeats or the possibilities that we'll rise again. Now, all of this thing is in the ballads, more so than a lot of other countries where the ballads generally are an entertainment medium. Some of the things Mick touched on, though, are appearing in the ballads. The fairy child has been mentioned in several ballads, in that the child, a normal child, gets sick and immediately the parents are faced with the chances of the child dying. They can't take it, so they presume that the fairies have come, swapped the healthy child that they had yesterday for the sickly child that they have today. The child dies, and I don't know one song. It's not a particularly nice song, but it goes, "A mother came while stars were paling, wailing round the lonely spring. Thus she cried while tears were falling, calling on the fairy king." And asking the fairy king to return her child and take back the dead child that she was left with. Other stories are, but the storytelling is coming back to a degree. At several sessions now over the last few years, the mumming play is coming back again because people want an expression of that sort. Also the storytelling. There's a man up in Armagh, John Campbell, who tells stories, and John just tells out the stories as part of a session of songs. And his stories will be about twice as long as a long song. And he fits in with a session, and it's very pleasant. It's much nicer than dealing with musicians. But the John tells, John, just remind you of a story he told the last time of a, I don't tell stories, I can't tell stories like your man here, but he told it of the farmer and the son, the mother, they were living alone for years and they were fed up because they were living up to there in clobber and they wouldn't tidy a place, the place was filthy, they were eating wherever they could find it, you know, and the life was just falling asunder. And the father says to your man, look, one of us will have to get.